Hi, you're tuned to Truth News Radio on the 5th of March 2016. Great to have you aboard. My name's Hereward Fenton and I will be your host for the next hour. On today's show, I'm going to be looking into the left-right paradigm, what I might call the left-right trap, because I do believe that in recent times, the political spectrum has been so polarized and so controlled by the left-right paradigm that those who accept these designations find that they are unwittingly drawn in to a kind of a polarized situation where they're not actually able to have independent viewpoints because of the pressure of this tendency to group beliefs and attitudes into either the left or the right pigeonholes. And it is a really big problem for freedom. And one has to admire the genius of the power elites who presumably control our dialogue and our political spectrum, that they are able to so easily control people's behavior by simply lumping people in either as left or right. I want to understand a little bit about the history of this concept, and I'm going to play you a few video clips. I'm going to play to you some clips from famous economist Friedrich von Hayek, something from Noam Chomsky, and also a clip from G. Edward Griffin. And let me emphasize that I do not adhere to any of these people. You'll notice some of the people I quoted there belong to different sides of the political divide, and that's, from my opinion, I don't have a problem with that at all. And in my own views, as I've stridently expressed them on this show, I often cross the line between left and right. I don't accept the grouping mechanism. I don't accept the designation. And I do find it to be a type of a trap. And it's one that people often fall into without realizing it. And, you know, the nature of human nature being what it is, people do feel comfortable belonging to some type of group. So once you've fallen in to the group designation, a lot of people go along with it because they think, well, I've got all these people who I roughly agree with, so I'll call myself right-wing. See, that's a mistake, and that's where you really need to step back and you need to take a broader view, a deeper view, a more historical view, and that's partly what I'm going to be doing today. Now, let's just briefly survey some of the topics that become controversial, that are sort of hot-button topics between left and right. Issues such as taxation, wealth redistribution, social security, universal health care, marriage equality, abortion, traditional morality versus sort of progressive morality, warfare and foreign interventions, economic freedom, and statute law. And there's a lot of detail in all of those topics that I won't have time to go into today. But each of those topics that I've just raised with you have kind of a left-wing and a right-wing slant. Of course, you know, left-wing people are supposedly pro-taxation. They are pro-social security. They are pro-universal health care. They are pro-wealth redistribution. They are pro-choice in matters of marriage equality, in matters of abortion, whereas right-wing people are against taxation, or for you know, they argue for less taxation. They are against social security, or argue for less. They are against universal health care. They are against wealth redistribution. And these are very commonly seen in discourse, and many people who belong to either the left or the right proudly advocate these viewpoints. But You know, what do we see less of, and it's actually very hard to find it on the internet, is a critique of the entire paradigm, is writers and researchers who are prepared to really investigate the distinctive features of left versus right, and to unflinchingly look at what we see in the modern world, what we see happening right now. And when people do that, when you're willing to do that, when you're willing to open your eyes, what you'll see is that both the advocates of the so-called left and so-called right in all modern Western societies have an awful lot in common, folks. They have more in common than they have which divides them. Of course, the hot-button topics like abortion and marriage equality are polarized topics. But, you know, they are actually minor issues. They are issues that are very, very important to powerful vocal minorities in our society. But they're still not the issues which preoccupy the vast, vast bulk of people. But when we come down to issues of taxation, social security, healthcare, the economic freedom, what we find is that they're almost identical. They don't vary much. But if we actually go into the history of the study of political philosophy and economic philosophy, what we do find is that in the classical critiques, for example, the critique of Hayek on modern socialism, Hayek pointed out that the central problem with socialism was the emphasis on central planning, which is also connected to an emphasis of collectivist political solutions. And this vision of the world as being best controlled by a collectivist, centrally organized governing system, unfortunately, has actually crept into both sides of politics. And we see it equally on the right and equally on the left. Now, some people, such as Noam Chomsky, view this as, well, the whole world has shifted to the right. But that's because Noam Chomsky, being so firmly aligned with a label, and I just called it a label, a sort of a meaningless label, of being a left-wing thinker, insists that everything that we're seeing now that is bad is actually a shift to the right. But then many other thinkers, people, for example, Ron Paul or some of the Tea Party people, see that the phenomena that we're seeing particularly in the United States, but applies to Australia as well, is kind of a shift towards socialism. So depending on your vested interests, you'll either see what's happening at the moment as a giant lurch towards the right or a giant lurch towards the left. And in a way, these are just labels, and the labels are losing their meaning. Interesting historical note is that left and right actually derive from the French Revolution. And I do have just a brief quote here that I'm going to give you from Wikipedia. The terms left and right appeared during the French Revolution of 1789, when members of the National Assembly divided into supporters of the king to the president's right and supporters of the revolution to his left. One deputy, the Baron de Gouville, explained, "We began to recognize each other. Those who were loyal to religion and the king took up positions to the right of the chair so as to avoid the shouts, oaths and indecencies that enjoyed free rein in the opposing camp. However, the right opposed the seating arrangement because they believed that deputies should support private or general interests but should not form factions or political parties." So that's just an interesting little anecdote there from history. But of course, the flavour of left versus right being progressive versus traditional stays with us. even though so much of the body, the actual content of what the so-called left versus right politicians advocate has tended to merge. Now, on that note, I want to actually read to you an article titled "Freedom is Neither Left Nor Right." And this is from thedailybell.com. And I thought this was a reasonable summary of what I actually believe and what I think is correct. The author of this article is Richard Ebeling, and it was authored in 2014. We live in a time when virtually all political parties and candidates stand for the same fundamental ideological idea: state interventionism and compulsory redistribution. This also applies to the mainstream media. Even many who say they adhere to a pro-market view of things, in fact, turn out to be only more moderate advocates of government regulations and welfare state programs. This is why political labels have become increasingly meaningless. Back in the 1950s and 1960s, it was a common practice in political discussions to refer to people on the left as socialists or communists and to call those on the right fascists or Nazis. American liberals were considered left-wingers who were for bigger government and sympathetic to socialism, while conservatives were viewed as right-wingers who were pro-big business and against the little guy, and therefore closet fascists. These distinctions were misplaced and irrelevant because in the reality of 20th century history, both left-wingers and right-wingers were merely two variations on the same collectivist theme. Both were devoted to government control of social and economic life, with only minor institutional differences between them. Marxian socialists advocated government nationalization and direct central planning of all production, while Italian fascists and German Nazis were for comprehensive government regulation and planning of all property that remained nominally in private hands. In addition, Marxists spoke of an international workers' revolution in comparison to fascists and Nazis who talked about nationalist and racial wars. Both socialists and fascists therefore believed that the world was divided into collective groups, social classes or races, that were inherently and inescapably in conflict with each other. The individual was denied meaning and existence outside of the tribe or social herd. In our own times, Mussolini and Hitler-type fascism is long a thing of the past, and Soviet-style socialism is now gone as well. Now, I'll just continue reading from this when we come back from the break. You're with Truth News Radio Australia, and I'm talking about the left-right divide and the kind of a trap that represents for thinkers and freedom-oriented souls. We'll be right back. Back here with Truth News Radio, and I'm just reading to you an article here from Richard Ebeling, July 2014, and I'm just getting on to the section here where he talks about left liberal denials of freedom. What we are left with in American politics are those who call themselves liberals or progressives versus conservatives and who claim to be ideologically very apart from each other. But are they really so far apart? On the left, the liberals say they are for civil liberties and personal freedom, but they continue to advocate ever more government regulation of business, redistribution of wealth, and various forms of social engineering to manipulate human relationships and attitudes. They never explain how personal freedom can be maintained and civil liberties secured if the government imposes a thought police to enforce politically correct conduct and language, or if society is divided into racial, ethnic, and gender groups, each to be assigned by political power certain affirmative favours and privileges at the expense of others. Nor can individual freedom be guaranteed when the government taxes away the wealth of some to redistribute to others deemed more deserving because of ideological influence or political clout. Likewise, liberty has very little meaning when government can seize people's property, regulate their business and industry, and interfere with the peaceful and voluntary exchanges that free men and women agree to for their mutual betterment. The left in America still does not get it. Freedom is an empty word if private property is not respected and if all human relationships are not based on personal consent. Now he turns to right conservative denials of freedom. On the right, in America, many conservatives still use the rhetoric of individual freedom and free enterprise. But beneath the surface, it is clear that too often this is mere form without content. And many mainstream conservatives have given up all interest and willingness to oppose and abolish the interventionist welfare state. They have made their own peace with big government. They believe that the wider American public cannot be weaned from political paternalism, so they have set themselves the more modest goal of getting control of the political machinery in order, supposedly, to manage the welfare state more cost-efficiently and to use it to direct society in better and more virtuous directions. Some 50 years ago, conservatives used to tell their opponents on the left, "You can't legislate morality." Better conduct could only come, they would say, through improvements in the individual human hearts of men and women and through the peaceful possibilities of voluntary association. Rarely is this heard anymore on the conservative right. Instead, too many conservatives wish to use the government to socially engineer their fellow Americans in only a different form than their opponents on the left. Conservatives merely vie over control of school boards and educational curricula to see that public government school imposes a mindset on the youth of America different than the one the progressives would like to successfully implement. Now, I'll just leave it there. It's a good article and there's a lot more to it. This really goes to the heart of some of the things we've been talking about on the show recently. And of course, last week I spent a long time talking about the controversy over the social engineering program Safe Schools Coalition and what that is doing to kind of undermine and erode individual freedom, individual choice. And, you know, it is a symptom of an attitude towards government which is still there on the right as much as it is on the left, even though at the moment we see the right complaining about this particular topic. You know, there are other programs that that they would probably support which do the same type of thing but aiming in a different direction. Now, the most famous critique of all this from the 20th century derives from a man by the name of Ludwig von Hayek. And, of course, his famous book, The Road to Serfdom, is an expose of, among other things, the way in which both socialism and fascism are actually interconnected. And the central failing principle being this concept that we can control society through a centralized power structure. And Hayek's views are really, really very advanced. They're even still a little ahead, I believe, of the times. What Hayek really understood was the power of true democracy. And by that I mean, in a pluralist society with millions of individuals, you have a vast reservoir of knowledge and opinion and expertise, and that true progress actually only comes when we are able to harness that. And that cannot happen when society is weighed down by this idea that everything will be made by some sort of central planning authority, that every decision will be made through some sort of central planning authority, and that society will be engineered to move in a particular direction. Because that is actually imposing a ridiculous limitation, and it is denying us the benefit of the vast wealth we have in the millions of people on this planet. And in order to harness that, we have to reduce central planning. We have to reduce centralized coercion. Now, I'm actually going to play to you a video clip of a recording done, just a short clip, with Hayek from the 1970s, where he illustrates this one very important point. Here we go.
Could I just interrupt at that point? You say socialism is impossible in a technical sense. Now, what exactly do you mean by that?
It proposes a solution which is not the solution. You cannot... Well, it takes a long time, but it's my central problem. Socialism assumes that all the available knowledge can be used by a single central authority. It overlooks that the modern society, which I now prefer to call the extended order, which exceeds the perception of any individual mind, is based on the utilization of widely dispersed knowledge. And once you are aware that we can achieve that great utilization of available resources only because we utilize the knowledge of millions of men, it becomes clear that the assumption of socialism that a central authority in command all this knowledge is just not correct.
So what you're doing is you're turning on its head the common point one often hears from the left, that because the problems of modern society are so difficult, that they require planning. You're saying because they're so complex, they make planning impossible.
Well, I think the nicest form to put it is to say that socialism, protesting against the production for profit and not for use, objects to what makes the extended society possible. Production for use is only possible in a society where we know all the facts. But to achieve the situation where we are all working for people whom we do not know, and are being supported by the work of people we do not know, is made possible because we produce for profit. Profit is a signal which tells us what we must do in order to serve people whom we do not know.
Yes. Now, Ewan von Mises put forward this criticism in the 20s. What reaction did you get from the socialists of the day?
Now, we're just about to go to break. I'll continue that when we come back. A very important point to understand here is this connection between the freedom to allow good solutions to be thought of from within society and the profit motive itself. We'll be right back.
We'll be right back.
Welcome back. You're with Truth News Radio. And I'm just playing here a clip of Friedrich von Hayek talking about the central problem with central planning, which is a key feature of socialism, but which is a key feature of all modern Western systems, or all modern governments have become addicted to this excess of social planning and social engineering. And a very important point that he was making there just before the end of the break there was that the profit motive is part of the way in which we are able to harness the power of vastly disparate individuals. And it allows a degree of freedom, a large degree of freedom, for people to engage in whatever they choose to, and to be driven by the profit motive. But let me just continue here from the video, which I think it probably explains it better than I can. So just returning you to that video now.
You and von Mises put forward this criticism in the 20s. Yeah. What reaction did you get from the socialists of the day? What reply did they make to that fundamental criticism?
They were unwilling to admit the factual argument. They preferred to withdraw on the tax. This is a difference of values on which science cannot decide. Once you accept the socialist values that we must be guided by a conception of just distribution, all the factual arguments are irrelevant. Well, of course, the factual arguments prove that the just distribution is impossible unless the distributor knows all the facts. So my answer is, if the factual assumptions of socialism were correct, it would be a moral duty to aim at the just distribution. But you have to recognize you cannot do it. In fact, you can produce enough as to maintain the present population of the world only because of a spontaneous process or mechanism which enables you to make use of infinitely more information than any central authority possesses.
Okay, now let me try and apply this to some of the more contemporary problems we've got, because a lot of what is going on now, it is partly what von Hayek was talking about there, but a lot of this decision-making and planning has now gone into the social engineering of society, or has gone into more and more obscure decisions that are made about how collective action needs to be taken. I say obscure in that they're harder and harder to prove. They're based on a belief that by taking these steps, by instituting programs, by in some cases raising taxes, that we will be able to steer society into this perfect direction. But as von Hayek says, in order to do that, you need a godlike level of knowledge, which no individuals have, no government has. We're becoming impoverished. We're losing the value and the wealth of knowledge and skills and thought, which is contained within this vast thing called humanity, by shrinking our horizon down to policies and objectives that can be contained within statute legislation designed to achieve a specific goal. And that's why in my introduction there, when I was talking about some of the distinctions between left and right, I actually talked about statute law as being one of the key features of a lot of left-wing thought, is that we've got to bring in a law for this, a law for that, a law to protect this group of people, a law to protect that group of people. And the legal system becomes weighed down by all this excessive legislation as well, creating vast bureaucracies and then confusion as to how that law should be applied, or even misuse and vexatious misuse of some of these laws, which can lead to persecution of harmless individuals. We live in a time where all of this has now sort of become more concentrated, and it becomes the central focus of government policy. Now, of course, it may seem that what I'm presenting to you here is I'm basically presenting to you myself as a right-wing individual, because a lot of what I'm saying does sound like I'm actually adopting the right-wing arm of this argument. However, let me counter that by saying that I don't dispute that government is useful, and I don't dispute that government has a role in regulating our society. As long as government hasn't exceeded its bounds and does actually represent the people, government simply becomes the focus, the lens, the funnel through which the people's will is directed. And of course, we have to have some mechanism of doing that. And that's what I see the mechanism of government as being. And although I do affirm the views of Hayek about the profit motive and free enterprise, I do believe that there's a lot of aspects in society where collective ownership is the only sensible position to take. I mean, and it's well recognized and understood that the air is collectively owned. But we don't even talk about it as being owned. We just allow for the fact that we all breathe air, you know, including animals, including birds, including plants. No one wants to come along and say, well, you know, we own the atmosphere. Similarly, I believe that resources like water resources and electricity and some basic infrastructure needs to be seen, and these are actually artificial creations in some cases, like dams and waterways and electrical power grids. These are best seen as not owned by private individuals or corporations. And most of us can see the value in that. And so by advocating that, I may be lumped in with a socialist viewpoint. And so people may accuse me of being a socialist. I'm in favour of some viewpoints which are regarded as socialist positions. I'm in favour of choice when it comes to abortion, but I do believe that abortion done beyond a certain date does become homicide, which does approximate to murder the older that embryo is. But I actually believe, and this is based on a lot of my own thinking and common sense, is that when a fetus is very, very small, that it is virtually indistinguishable from, say, a sperm cell or an egg cell, and that we can't control people down to that extent of applying strict punitive laws about their management of their sperm and egg cells. And therefore, also, I believe that we can't enforce that level of restrictive control over people, over women who become pregnant in the first 8 weeks of pregnancy. And I know this is a controversial topic. There are various other topics in which I cross the line between left and right. I mean, I'm critical of the right-wing position about ownership of guns, not because I think that gun ownership should be strictly regulated and harsh laws such as we have in Australia are good. I'm against those harsh laws, right? But I feel that a lot of the right-wing position on gun ownership is actually based on an attitude towards humanity which I do not share. We'll get back into it when I get back from the break. You're with Truth News Radio Australia. Stay with us. I'm getting into some tricky subjects, which require me to think very carefully about what I say.
What happens in terms of creating wars is a mind manipulation technique called problem reaction solution. And it works like this. First of all, you create the problem, but you get someone else to be blamed for it. You then report that problem through the media in the way you want it reported. You get the public to react to your problem by saying something must be done, this can't go on, what are they going to do about it?
Hi, welcome back. And just continuing there from the break, I just wanted to point out that my view about gun ownership is that, first of all, I think it should be far less regulated than it is, certainly in Australia. However, I believe there are a couple of fallacies that people believe in regard to gun ownership. One of the main ones being that it is believed that allowing citizens to have access to automatic weapons will be an effective bulwark against tyranny. The problem there being that governments, because of where we've gone with technology, because of this, the wealth that governments now have, the amount of firepower that governments can muster in response to any kind of citizen militia is always going to be 100 to 1. It's going to be, unless we start legalizing mortars and artillery and perhaps nuclear weapons for personal use, which I think most people don't agree with. I think if you were going to be sensible and take that argument that the citizens need to have access to all kinds of firepower to protect the citizenship against tyranny, well then, yes, heavy arms, depleted uranium weapons, and indeed nuclear weapons should be something that you could legally buy as a citizen, because that's what it's going to require, ultimately, if you go up against a major militarized government force. But look, I don't want to go on too much about that. I just want to play to you now a quick clip from Edward Griffin. And again, I'm not peddling the thoughts of Edward Griffin here. I don't agree with a lot of what Edward Griffin has said in some other topics, but I do actually like this particular interview, and we'll only be able to play a bit of it, but it's from an interview that he did on Infowars.com, which explains his take on the left-right paradigm. Here we go.
The growth of the Tea Party movement and the left-right paradigm, they're all sort of intertwined, and yet there are very separate intellectual threads that need to be followed in all of that. I think, first of all, it's important to talk about and understand this left-right paradigm. What is this all about? Most of us, including myself for certain, in my younger years, I was brought up thinking that you had to choose, if you were smart at least, you would have to choose politically between being on the right or the left. You had to have a political view. And I thought that in those days, I thought that the extreme right would be something like fascism or Nazism. And on the extreme left, of course, you would have communism or socialism, just a little bit short of that. So that was the paradigm that I was taught, and it seemed to make sense at the time. But as I became more involved in these issues and learned more about them, I began to realize that the basic philosophy between the so-called extreme left people, on communists and socialists, and the so-called philosophy on the right of the fascists and the Nazis was really the same. I said, how can this be? They're supposed to be opposites of each other. And then I began to realize that there is something more common to all of these philosophies that was left out of my training and education. And that was the ideology of collectivism. Began to realize that the thing that was common to them all is something called collectivism. Now, that's a word that is not very well used. It's not very entrenched in the vocabulary of most people today. But I found out that it was a very commonly used word about a century ago. People wrote a lot about collectivism, and the opposite of that would be individualism. Those are two words that are sort of abandoned today. But in my view, I think they need to be recaptured and understood and used more. And I realized that communism and fascism, the so-called opposites, are merely variants of collectivism. They're the same thing. and they believe that the group is more important than the individual, for example, and the individual must be sacrificed, if necessary, for the greater good of the greater number. They believe that the state should be all-powerful and that the people should obey the state for the greater good of the greater number and all of that sort of thing. They believe that rights are granted by the state. They're not part of the human being. They're not God-given. They're not entrenched in his body and soul. They have to be granted by the state. All of these things, and you look at them one by one, communists and fascists and Nazis and socialists, they all believe that. So wherein lies the conflict, you see? And I began to question that. Now I realize that it's partly a trick. In fact, I think it's a huge trick. It's a great scam because people even today are thinking that they have to choose between the right or the left, not realizing that no matter which way they go, they've accepted basically the same ideology underneath.
And that's it. That's it, I believe, beautifully stated, and I agree with that 100%. It is a trick, it is a scam, and it is a trap indeed. And it is a trap that we are encouraged to fall into, and I believe it is a trap that many intellectual people also fall into. And I want to actually play to you a clip here from Noam Chomsky, who again is a man who I don't uncritically support, but I do respect a lot of what he has said. A lot of his analysis is spot on, but then there are some places where it seems to me that Noam Chomsky loses all his critical perspective. And in this interview, which was done with host Abby Martin, and it's an interview that was done, I believe, on RT with Abby Martin. Actually, it may be more recent than that, but anyway, it's on YouTube right now. And in this particular interview, Chomsky appears to be lumping all political parties and the entire spectrum of what we see in America now with the right. And an interesting thing about Chomsky is that you'll never hear him use terms like collectivism or central planning, because this was the rhetoric of the so-called right-wing philosophers like von Hayek. And you never see him really address the critique of collectivism. You never see him really bring this up. And so when he talks about the right, he seems to be talking generally about excessive power, excessive control, loss of rights, loss of freedoms, and excessive foreign interventions. But he never talks about the extremes of the left that are done in the name of the greater benefit for the greater good. He simply just doesn't mention it. And so when he talks about the malaise affecting modern American politics, he describes it as everything having slid to the right. And I'll just play that for you right now.
As extreme as the political spectrum is right now in the U.S., there's still almost complete uniformity on the war on terror, the stance toward Latin America, sanctions on Iran, and there's really no anti-war candidate, despite popular opinion agreeing on that. Why can no candidate touch that?
The spectrum is broad, but in an odd sense. The spectrum is basically from center to extreme right, way off the spectrum. So the Republican Party about 20 years ago basically abandoned any pretense of being a normal political party. In fact, distinguished, respected conservative commentators from the American Enterprise Institute, right-wing think tank like Norman Ornstein, described the Republican Party as a radical insurgency which has abandoned parliamentary politics. They just don't want anything to happen. Their only policies are don't do anything or bomb. That's not a political party. It's what happened is that the party, during the whole neoliberal period, both parties shifted to the right, as everywhere in the world, and the Republicans just went off the spectrum. They became so dedicated to the interests of the extreme wealthy and powerful that they couldn't get votes. So they had to turn to other constituencies, which are there, but were never politically mobilized. Christian evangelicals, nativists who are afraid they're taking our country away from us, people who are so terrified that they have to carry a gun into a coffee shop, and that's their base, essentially. And when you look at what, just take a look at the primaries, I mean, any candidate who has a semblance of rationality is not even competing. It's, so that's the Republicans. The
I just have to leave it there. Important point to note is that in Abby Martin's question to Noam Chomsky, she frames the entire question only in terms of foreign policy. She only talks about foreign policy. And when Noam Chomsky critiques American foreign policy, he's generally spot on. And so when he talks about aggressive foreign policy and American domination and empire as being a right-wing phenomenon, he's correct. It is a right-wing phenomenon, and it's also equally evident on the faux left. And he points that out quite correctly. So the Democrats and the Republicans have been equally guilty of warmongering and doing terrible things in other countries. But then he characterizes that as the entire spectrum of politics in the US having shifted to the right. There's no mention of the other, so many other issues of policy within society that have been the subject of critique, even from the left, even the Universal Health Care Act in the United States has been attacked from the left because it is essentially a corporatist imposition on people's freedom, forcing people to buy health care and then handing that over to the enormously corrupt pharmaceutical industry. But he never criticizes the pharmaceutical industry. He never criticizes aspects of society which are loosely defined as socialist implementations. Okay, that's our show for today. I hope you enjoyed it. I tried to give you a balanced perspective, and I hope you understand more about where I'm coming from on this show. Next week, I have a really important interview coming up with Kevin Miller about the psychiatry industry and SSRI drugs. We'll be back next week. See you then.